Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their ongoing support. Well, one of the reasons for doing this program at all is because there is just a never-ending supply of world-class, cutting-edge research going on right here under our noses in the Triangle, and yet we never seem to hear enough about it. Case in point, did you know that we have a pilot program underway that is poised to revolutionize the all-important areas of health surveillance, biomonitoring, and biopreparedness? Well, we do, and it's an ambitious public-private partnership called NCB Prepared. It is actively gathering and crunching huge amounts of data from all over North Carolina, taking full and visionary advantage of the extraordinary resources we have available in computational firepower and public health and biomedical expertise. So today it is my distinct pleasure to welcome Dr. David Potenziani to Radio In Vivo, who will tell us all about this remarkable initiative. Dave has been executive director of NCB Prepared since its founding in 2010. Prior to joining NCB Prepared, he held a variety of positions at the UNC Gillings School of Public Health since 1994, and before that he was involved in the IT industry for many years. And just as we hooked up this morning, we realized we actually worked together back in the 80s, I guess it must have been. So it's kind of old home week here on Radio In Vivo. Dave earned his PhD and MA in history from the University of Georgia in 1981 and 1978, respectively, following his BA from Eastern Illinois University in 1976. Dave, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
It's good to be here.
Dave, first of all, I'd like to establish the background about NCB Prepared. It's a very catchy name, but what exactly is this organization?
It's actually, currently, it's a federally funded project, and it's a partnership between UNC Chapel Hill, NC State University, and SAS Institute. And the idea is to develop a new type of biosurveillance system based on a very large universe of data, based on cutting-edge analytics, as well as backed up by expertise in computer science, veterinary medicine, as well as the human health sciences.
So what exactly does NCB Prepared stand for? Because I think there's a misconception maybe that it's North Carolina be prepared.
And it began that way.
I see. Okay.
And so, but after our first year, our funding agency in the Department of Homeland Security suggested that because we were on a trajectory to provide national service, that we consider changing our name to reflect that. So we became the National Collaborative for Biopreparedness. NCB Prepared still rolls off the tongue rather well, and so we usually refer to ourselves by that.
I see. So you didn't have to change the logo or anything.
It was very efficient.
Indeed, indeed. How did this group come to be established? Where did this come from?
I'm one of the few who was sort of present before the creation. This goes back more than 4 years ago. It was actually a discussion group that met Friday mornings at a Cafe Carolina shop in Cary. And it was a free-ranging conversation group, and there were people from communication sciences, veterinary medicine, computer science, as well as analytics. And they started recognizing that there was a fundamental shift taking place, or in some ways had taken place, where long ago, and as a recovering historian, I have some bona fides in this space, information has been locked up on paper, and which makes it durable but difficult to access.
Sure.
And in our lifetimes, for sure, we've seen information start becoming electronic, and that the number of sources and the amount of data that is being stored in electronic resources is exploding at an exponential rate. That gives us an opportunity to ask some questions that we could not answer previously, because just the logistics of pulling together the data and then being able to understand it were too daunting. And so we saw this as to use Thomas Kuhn's notion, that this was the beginning of a paradigm shift.
Sure.
Where suddenly nowadays people talk about this as big data.
Right.
And that, mm-hmm. you know, you can apply analytics to big data. You can ask kinds of questions that you couldn't ask before, and sometimes get surprising answers. Probably most people would relate to the two authors of the Freakonomics books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are people who are looking at data in different ways, surprising ways, and coming up with sometimes interesting, occasionally vexing conclusions that challenge all of us sometimes. People have responded to say, well, you know, the rigor wasn't there, or you had this kind of issue. But it's actually part of the process. The scientific endeavor is to ask questions that are unusual, different, divergent. And so
allow for serendipity.
Exactly. And so this project sort of came out of that kind of tradition. We kind of say that we're 37 degrees in orientation away from everybody else in every direction. And so we've had our own challenges where people have said, I don't know that this approach is really going to be helpful. I don't know this is really going to pan out.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is, as I got involved, I was brought in, invited in by the then dean of the School of Information and Library Sciences here at UNC, and started sitting in on these sessions. I found them intellectually stimulating, fascinating, and I was able to bring what I had picked up in 12, 13 years in the School of Public Health, working with people across the variety of disciplines, and as well as supporting educational programs. Mm-hmm. So I had an affinity for what this group was trying to do. And the premise was relatively straightforward. Now we have these data resources we never had before. We have very good and improving analytical skills. We certainly have pockets of expertise on the relevant sciences, biological and otherwise.
Right.
Can't we put these together? Can't we make a contribution? Because, and this was maybe one of the things that I was able to help contribute, was the perspective from the domain of public health. Another fundamental shift that has taken place in our lifetimes is transportation. Many times diseases are move across borders and oceans very rapidly.
Sure.
One of the value proposition statements that we begin with is to say that in a practical sense, we are one day of travel away from almost any place on the earth. Therefore, whatever disease or health issues that may be spreadable that pertain there could be on our doorsteps tomorrow. Now, that is a very different world than generations past have dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And the speed of response to address those health threats has to be just as rapid. The challenge is, how do you speed up that process when the data universe is still fragmentary? The analytical tools still need more work and development. And of course, all of this was took place inside the consequences of 9/11, but more particularly for our project, the anthrax attacks in New York and more principally in Washington, D.C. later that year.
Mm-hmm.
Those shook the public health and emergency response. Those events took those two domains, shook them to their foundations. And I remember talking to people at CDC afterwards, and they had that summer in 2001 developed what they thought was the full comprehensive plan for a bioterrorist attack. And they realized very quickly that assumptions they had made no longer held, that they were taken quite by surprise, and that they weren't ready. They didn't have the resources, the capabilities, and they certainly did not have anything like early detection, much less a predictive capability to understand these issues. So all of that was part of the stew, intellectual stew of this group. And we continued to meet regularly for these 90-minute, two-hour conversations. I had the freedom to be able to devote that time, thanks to the School of Public Health. And what we eventually did is cooked up a proposal for a three-year project that if we could achieve funding, we would be able to do a proof of concept, we would be able to scale it to an appropriate size for national service, and then bring it out to be able to fulfill that.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's taken a little longer, as these things usually do.
Indeed.
But we actually were funded officially in FY 2010.
All right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're 2 years in at this
yes.
point.
Yes. And this was, to truth in advertising, one of the hated earmarks.
Oh, no.
yes. But what we thought distinguished us is, of course, this was something that came through the university system. So there were several levels of vetting, both at the campus level and at the general administrative level.
Sure.
But we were able to pitch it, and coincidentally, in fact, we were only dimly aware of the issues that the federal government had in this space, particularly in Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
But we made our pitch to Congressman David Price, who had become increasingly concerned that the approaches that were being used, the investments that were being made by various parts of the federal government, but particularly Homeland Security, weren't necessarily going to get the traction that we all wanted.
Sure, or have all the dots connected appropriately.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did is we basically said, look, consider who we are. The depth of expertise at UNC in the health sciences and information science, the depth of expertise at NC State in computer science and veterinary medicine and food safety, and the depth of experience at SAS Institute in analytics as well as large systems development.
Right.
Mm-hmm. This was a combination of strength that is unique, as far as we can tell, anywhere in the world.
Sure.
And the fact that we're all within the same general drivable neighborhood helps a lot.
As I said in my intro, this is one of these unique to North Carolina, and more particularly the Triangle-type projects where, groups of visionaries come together and spawn something amazing. Reading over the materials, it kept reminding me of the genesis of Research Triangle Park itself.
Yes.
That is something very special that we have here that is not recreatable elsewhere.
Right. And this was a combination of things in terms of different kinds of sciences that are somewhat distinctive, mm-hmm. And draw on the strengths in this area. I come at this from background and experience in information technology. And then we have, combined these strengths so that the principal investigator of our project, the person that I report to and work most closely with, is Dr. Charles Cairns. Chuck is the chair and professor of emergency medicine at UNC. But he is also very skilled in biostatistics because his parents were psychologists at UNC, and he sort of grew up over his oatmeal in the morning talking mm-hmm. about statistics and helping his parents with their work. Mm-hmm. So this is a wonderful combination of talents.
Bleeds Tar Heel Blue.
Yes. So once we were funded, then, in a way,
and that came from Homeland Security.
It came
right?
through Homeland yeah. Security, yeah. and that started the clock running, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Our first year was trying to put together a critical mass of data sources, some of which had never been used for health surveillance before, certainly on the scale that we had talked about. And what we did is, as we thought about the data domains, we also recognized that our mandate. And this is actually from a presidential directive, that biosurveillance has to look at the biosphere. We have to understand what is going on in the biosphere in order to help protect human beings from health threats.
Okay.
And
before you press on, could you define biosphere for our listeners and in turn biosurveillance?
Okay. Well, for us, one of the ways that we express the biosphere is just showing a picture of the entire Earth from space and say, this is where the action is for our species. Human beings live in a complex set of systems where living beings as well as natural processes interact.
Mm-hmm.
This is not only where we live, it's where we eat, we raise our families, where we die. And human beings have achieved a sense of self-awareness about the biosphere that we think may be distinctive, difficult to say because we can't communicate completely with other species. But nonetheless, this is where we live, and it's the only home we're likely to have. And the challenge, though, is the biosphere, even though it encompasses all living things, also has the reasons why we die, why we get ill.
Mm-hmm.
And we started looking at, well, what are the factors involved in causing illness and death? Some of them are infectious diseases. They could be bacteriological or viral. Sometimes it's contributing factors. It's too hot. It's too cold. Sometimes it's trauma. But what we did is we said, all right, let's look at things that kill us and divide them into two groups. Those things that we can surveil and those things that are outside our realm. And for us, the things that we can surveil are living processes that have biological origin and a biological nature. So that would include viruses and bacteria. Would not necessarily include larger economic factors. Warfare,
sure,
things like that, unless those kinds of weapons are used.
Indeed, sure, okay. Absolutely.
And so biosurveillance is essentially looking at data sources across the biosphere as best you can achieve that and be able to look for things that are threats to human health, things that in technical terms would cause morbidity, illness, or mortality, death.
Right.
And the idea is that all of us, hopefully, will lead long, healthy, and rich lives. But many of us do not. And sometimes that's because of two sources of factors. One is, of course, human-engineered issues, like the anthrax attacks. Anthrax is a natural pathogen. It exists in the wild. But one of the things we found out that this was a weaponized version, therefore more easily ingested, inhaled by mm-hmm. human beings, and it took a lot of people by surprise
right.
that it could be delivered through a communication system known otherwise as the U.S. Postal Service.
Right.
That was part of what shook everybody up, because nobody had thought you could mail these spores and that would be your delivery mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is a human-engineered event that, or human-engineered threat of a biological nature you're trying to understand. And we've gone through a number of really sometimes very worrisome types of thought scenarios.
I can imagine.
How could this mm-hmm. happen? What do we need to look at in order to detect that? The other side of it is naturally occurring outbreaks. These tend to be what are called zoonotic. And those are where non-human animals may have a health issue, a pathogen, a disease that can cross the divide into human beings. And typically these are threats that are most vexing for us as human beings, because they're coming from species that aren't us. Therefore, our species has probably never seen such a pathogen, and our immune systems don't know how to respond. HIV mm-hmm. is one of these.
Sure.
Even though it had a very long incubation period, which is part of the reason it spread so rapidly, we still haven't figured out or are just now figuring out how to really combat this. And we've been throwing everybody and our best, scientists and best techniques at that problem for decades.
Right.
But these zoonotic issues are actually increasing. And the reason is, and I saw a presentation by a member of the USAID agency, and they were goal is to help promote economic development, particularly in the resource challenged areas of the world, poor mm-hmm. countries.
Sure.
And this person had said their agency had been tracking zoonotic agents and finding that as we develop formerly remote places, the upper reaches of the Amazon basin, the Congo basin, the Mekong basin, etc., that these areas had indigenous populations that had lived there for a long time, but now that they were usually doing natural resource extraction and they were bringing out minerals, woods, people were moving in and out of these areas, and what those diseases that may have been localized are now traveling with them, with the people and the products coming
sure.
out.
And being exposed to some of these rather obscure species of wildlife.
I'm exactly, sure. exactly. Now, and some of this has to do with in Africa, where people will try to find protein where they can, and mm-hmm. sometimes they will hunt primates and eat the meat, and sometimes that meat will have pathogens and they will spread into the human population. And so,
which is a suspicion of where HIV came from.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the challenge, of course, is that as we do this economic development, these outbreaks become more frequent. These are issues that are always serious, and we need to have a system that allows us to see the light coming over the horizon,
sure.
to be able to have advance warning. And that's really what biosurveillance is meant to do. Mm-hmm. There are two components, as we view it, in our mission space. One is to help people understand the issue earlier, and the second is to help them understand the issue. What is its character? Where is it? What is its trend? How serious is it? And that, all taken together, is considered to be situational awareness. And what that does is, if you have that level of knowledge and understanding, then you can make appropriate responses. The challenge is, quite often, the issue will spread beyond a local area and therefore will overcome the resources available to contain it or to mitigate its effects.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what we're about is helping bring that information to the front line of people involved in understanding it and being able to address it locally or address it within a system of production or movement of goods and people. So if you can catch it early, like a lot of medical issues, then you become able to address it. One of the metaphors we use is the immune system. The human immune system works in a way, and speaking as an information technologist, I have almost no expertise in this, but part of it is a local response. If, you know, sometimes if you have an insect bite or something like that, it may become infected, and initially it's localized. It hurts, it's red, it itches, and so on. But, and if it is a pathogen that spreads within your body, then the issue becomes systemic. And that's when it's very concerning because your health is at risk as well as perhaps your life.
Indeed.
So what we try to do is figure out ways that we can bring all this data together and then express it in an easily understandable way to the person who is in the local community or is working in the grocery store chain or wherever. So that the idea is if we can catch it early, we can address it. And it's amazing, but many of the public health techniques that have been developed over the past century are still very effective. It's just knowing where and when to apply them.
So
quarantines still work.
Right, right.
But you have to know where, and you have to understand how this is emerging.
Mm-hmm.
So the challenge, though, is you need to get the data. And where biosurveillance has emerged in the past 10, 15 years has been looking at what we consider the middle of the Oreo, that sweet, sweet center that involves human clinical data. So these are, your physician's medical records of you, resulting public health records, of reportable or notifiable cases. You know, if you get influenza and your physician diagnoses you, that's reported because that's a serious infectious disease. And
sure.
There are others as well.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, particularly in a discipline or a process called syndromic surveillance, and UNC is one of the leaders in this, a program related to ours called NC Detect, which I would argue is one of the best of its kind in the world. They use emergency department data to be able to understand what is happening before there's a diagnosis, before the clinician says, oh, this is X, I need to report it. And so they use syndromes, that is, patterns of symptoms that relate to specific diseases, and be able to look at those patterns to be able to surface that notice. It's suggestive, not conclusive.
Right.
But the State Division of Public Health epidemiologists, as well as epidemiologists in the larger hospitals, look at that resulting data to mm-hmm. determine, do we need to open an investigation? Do we need to start thinking about this in a larger way?
Sure. And so how is what you're doing with NCB Prepared different from that existing biosurveillance system, which we have at the local, state,
right.
national, and international levels?
It actually has to do with we complement what we do. We say that we stand on the shoulders of the people who've done this work. And they're pretty tall shoulders.
Indeed.
but one of the ways that we look at it is, can we reach further away in time to what they're doing? Part of their challenge is, even in North Carolina, which is has the fastest rate of moving emergency department records to the state level and then a subset to CDC,
mm-hmm.
every 12 hours. And
wow,
in this space, that is light speed.
Sure.
We say that we need to do even better than that. But in order to do that, we have to look at different kinds of data. And data that is in a different place in the evolution of what we call an incident. An incident to us is when there is a health threat that it's manifested in the in human morbidity and mortality. So one of the first places that we started looking were ambulance records. These are emergency medical services. There typically are not physicians involved in on an ambulance run, but they are trained personnel, emergency medical technicians and paramedics. And the EMS records give us a slightly earlier time frame in an incident.
Sure.
As well as, similar to the emergency department, typically people who call for an ambulance are acutely ill.
Right.
And so, you know, it's rarely for trivial issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that does is it actually is the first step in the encounter of an individual in the healthcare system. And so we spent a good portion of our first year looking at statewide EMS data. And what we were able to do is apply traditional syndromic surveillance tools, some enhancements to those tools, and an underlying, and this is where SAS's contribution was extremely valuable, to address the data quality issues that those records present. All data sources are messy.
Sure.
The metaphor I've used is looking into somebody's closet at home. It's always a mess. And you don't invite your guests to view your bedroom closet because, well, one, there's no reason, but also it's a mess. Well, everybody's data is like that. So one of the things that we have been able to do is use some very powerful tools and some very skilled teams to address those quality issues, because the old adage still works, garbage in, garbage out.
Sure, sure.
So the EMS data allowed us to start in a process that we call data discovery. And in part, this begins with the analytics team being partially blinded in the sense that we don't necessarily pair them immediately with clinicians, physicians, and other experts. We basically give them, once we've gone through the data cleaning step, we'd like you to find the anomalies in the data. We want everything run in association with everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then that surfaces a set of anomalies. And at that point, let's start first analyzing, are these statistically valid? Just in terms of the math.
Sure.
And then we bring in subject matter experts to help them have a conversation. And this can go on for some days.
I'll bet.
but it's fascinating because then, in this case, we worked with the medical director for the EMS system.
Okay.
And his staff. And we were able to develop sets of complementary syndromes, not quite related to disease, but rather related to a more general condition. For example, gastrointestinal distress can be caused by any number of issues. They could be foodborne contaminants. It could be disease. So there are many, many potential causes. But if someone calls for an ambulance because they are having gastrointestinal distress, and it could, you know, involve all of the dreadful human functions that we can think of,
right?
you know, things coming out of your body that don't normally, or in a way that don't normally, and it's incredibly, you know, uncomfortable, and it shows that there's something seriously wrong.
Right.
By essentially creating a bucket, a clinical bucket like that, we could start asking questions of the data that formerly we might not have been able to. It did the same thing with respiratory distress. We did the same thing with, and this is a little bit closer to the traditional syndromic surveillance, a set called influenza-like illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
But the
which is something that we try to be have sentinels.
Yes.
Out there to detect as early as possible. So I take it that's where this kind of contribution can really be critical.
Exactly. But what one of the differences that we brought to the table is that the analytics team that were working on this came out of what you might consider to be an unusual vector. That's why the 37 degree.
Mm-hmm.
comment. They had spent the previous several years working for financial institutions to detect fraud.
Okay.
As well as other parts, and particularly in the federal government, you know, trying to find patterns that would help them understand is there fraud taking place.
So it's all pattern recognition and
it's very much pattern recognition.
Signal to noise.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the signal to noise ratio is always a concern. And we address it in a couple of ways. One is improve the data, improve the quality of the data some novel techniques and some really good tools. The second is set our standards pretty high. So if we generate an alert, it's because it's 3 standard deviations or more from the mean, which by itself is sort of a blunt force way to reduce the number of points that generate noise. There are other more detailed kinds of approaches, but what we did in the EMS space is, of course, we applied the better traditional tools because just the data was cleaner, but we weren't satisfied with that. That improved some of the earlier detection by some small measure, but then we recognized that the interesting part about EMS records, and these are created every time you call an ambulance. The crew is making records, they're making recordings of clinical symptoms reported by the patient or the family or whoever, the person who can describe what's happening. So that's in lay terms. They're also making their clinical observations. So there are trained people, so they're looking at this from a clinical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And in the play of these free text fields, and there are a lot of normalized fields, that is categories that are chosen, but in these free text fields, we said, you know, we haven't really mined these very well. So let's apply these buckets, gastrointestinal distress, on these types of data because, one, yes, we can create what's called a taxonomy, basically a list of contributing terms or synonyms that in the vernacular as well as in the scientific language that people use just to record what's taking place. On the other hand, this is a social system. There are almost always 2 or more people on the technical team as well as the patient and whoever else is involved.
Sure.
And these text fields, in a sense, record some of this. The interplay, the result of the interplay of people trying to understand what is the nature of this issue, how, you know, what can we do right here? Do we need to move the person to an emergency department at a hospital?
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of this, we saw this as a micro social media environment. And by applying our taxonomies, what we were able to do is show an association, not necessarily cause and effect,
right,
but an association of gastrointestinal issues in the case of our study, 60 days ahead of the peak of an outbreak.
60 days. Wow.
60 days.
That's very impressive.
Now, this was in 2000, began in 2009 and carried over into 2010.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. This is where blinding the analysts is helpful because they didn't know what was going on. They just saw this anomaly in the data associated with gastrointestinal distress.
So leaving as much bias out of it as possible.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it was only after they'd completed their analysis and talked to, you know, and showed us what they had, how they had generated this first alert in early December of 2009, and they had seen that there was this outbreak based on number of EMS runs per day across the whole state. It peaked in February of 2010.
Wow. So what type of outbreak was it, actually?
That's when they said, you know, we probably ought to find out what this was.
Yeah.
So they started Googling and found out it was a norovirus outbreak.
Oh, wow.
And now some of that is natural. There's a seasonality to norovirus, but they had already factored that into their model.
Okay.
And so this was way outside that. This was 3 standard deviations above the mean. You've eliminated way more than 95% of the variability that is noise.
Mm-hmm,
and so what they were able to show was the alerts began in early December, repeated in early January, and then repeated in tighter and tighter time frames. sort of like when you drop a ball and it bounces once, and then again, and again, and again, and again. It mm-hmm. increases in speed.
Okay.
The cycles increase in speed, and they saw the same phenomenon. But their first signal, in fact, the first three of these signals, were at, when you looked at the rest of the data, it was completely normal. There was not a detectable change in the background number of cases.
Wow, okay.
And so they were suggesting that at least we have perhaps, and if we can replicate this in other data sets and other issues, et cetera, this may give us, like a weather forecast, some notion of what might be coming, but it's never perfect. And
sure.
That's why when we look at the weather forecast every morning to figure out, do I need to take an umbrella or not, it's couched in probabilities.
Right.
And we've all learned how to interpret those.
Yes. On the other hand, of course, you and I are of an age where we remember you didn't trust the weather forecast. You'd be crazy to, back in our youth. But today, weather forecasting is pretty darn reliable.
It is. It is much more reliable. When I was, I grew up in Northern Illinois and watched the TV weather guy on Channel 2.
right.
And his name was P.J. Hoff. And whenever he gave the forecast for the next day, he had a big piece of newsprint, and he would cartoon what John Q. Public should wear that day. And because it was a cartoon, he brought a sense of playfulness to this, because implicitly he was saying, you can't take my word for it.
Right, right. My guest on Radio and Vivo today is Dr. David Battenziani, and he is executive director of this remarkable organization called NCB Prepared, which is still in its pilot phase. Hopefully it's going to be showing a lot of successes over the third year of the three-year grant and looking like it'll roll out nationally. What's it looking like in those terms, Dave?
Okay. Well, we have actually moved beyond North Carolina in terms of our data space. We have EMS data now from North and South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And we have
other... You can't
other...
trust what you're getting out of South Carolina. Carolina.
Yeah. We have some very good friends there.
Oh, good. Okay.
But the we also have other kinds of data sources, some of which are national in scope. One of the other things that we've done is move beyond just emergency department and EMS data. We have data from poison control call centers.
Mm-hmm.
We are about to get a data set from 911 call centers.
Great.
We have data relating to businesses. We have data nationally on food safety issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we see is a growing set of data, some of which are amenable to our analytics and some of which are contextual.
Sure.
Meteorological data is contextual.
Mm-hmm.
Health resources data is contextual.
What about social media data? Because I know that social media in and of itself, Facebook, has been used for early detection of disease patterns.
And probably the best of those has been Google Flu. It's called, official name is Google Flu Trends.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so what we've been doing is we have some social media data and a set of tools that allow us to analyze that, but in two ways. What the folks at Google Flu Trends and other people who've used Twitter or Facebook kinds of data do, in part, of course, a lot of that, the analysis in that area is particularly of interest to companies that are trying to understand how do people believe about them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So these are affinities that they're trying to calculate. We recognize that we're looking at something a little different. What we're trying to do is essentially the same kind of thing, build taxonomies in these general categories and be able to understand what these social media can say to us in two ways. One is, if you, say, are looking at a respiratory issue, upper respiratory, and somebody says, I caught a cold,
mm-hmm.
that term, cold, may be used in very different ways. It could just be that's the temperature and how I feel, or it could be I have a disease that we all know as the common cold.
Sure.
So how do you tease those apart? So part of that is
you bring
more
sass in.
Exactly. But part of it is, you know, to apply the analytical tools,
right,
because these terms exist within a context, within a record.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part of this is trying to understand the social networking beyond just the chatter to see if there are points, if we can, because everything on the web is linked in some fashion, and many of those links are visible, then you can build a social network that allows you to understand, is there a thought leader in this space on this issue?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be dynamic. You have to calculate it, recalculate it all the time as the data is shifting. But that's part of how we want to tease this out, to be able to not just bring in the social media as we're looking at the frequency of these terms, but rather to understand, well, how do these things link together? Because human beings are creating, they're recording these terms and posting them.
Sure.
And so our approach is, first, can we line up Google Flu with other sources of information that we have and see where are we ahead, where are we behind the curve in terms of the time frame?
Okay.
But we also want to move beyond that to combine data sources either at the signal level where, okay, we get this three sigma signal from this source and this source and this source, but also to be able to take some baby steps toward true integration of the data where we apply analytical tools across a sort of a pan set of data, many mm-hmm. sources, same tool.
Sure. That's something I was going to ask you specifically about was how you're approaching integrating the data, because I know in the biomedical field, that's a very hot topic right now and the subject of a lot of intensive activity, because there are so many sources of data and huge amounts of data, but they don't necessarily all want to talk to each other readily.
And it works in a couple of different levels. You know, the joke is when you see one clinical data system, you've seen one clinical data system.
Right.
Okay. And of course, the work, you know, going back 25 years on data standards is just beginning to bear fruit.
Mm-hmm.
So those data standards are actually very helpful and part of what makes us possible.
Okay.
Because before mm-hmm. those standards existed, and particularly with the American Recovery Act funding that said, thou shalt have an electronic medical system and it shall be certified based on these standards, HL7, ICD-9, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
that without those standards, it's you're just creating a Tower of Babel. But the standards are implemented in slightly different ways. The standards have enough of gray fringes that sometimes the data from this place and that place are difficult to roll up. So part of what we've done is, in a very limited sense, tried to map those differences and compensate for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's an ongoing process. And so that's why the data discovery process is a fairly involved one. But then it's followed by a step that we call data integration. And currently, the way we have found, because we're in a hurry, we want to get this thing out there so it's
right.
useful,
mm-hmm.
The approach that we have taken to get that out into utility is to essentially integrate the signals. To be able to show repeated signals in this way within a data set or between data sets, sort of create a critical mass of information. What we want to do is provide people information rather than access to data.
Sure.
And
sure.
Because a lot of people want to look at the data, but the response we would give is, well, yeah, but 4 million records went into that piece of information. You can't really look at that. That's not humanly possible.
Sure.
And so what we want...
And there are privacy issues you
exactly.
have to deal with.
And
well.
The privacy issues are amazing.
I bet.
Because it's more than just... I mean, we're... it's more than just personal health information. It's more than a person's identity. Sometimes these data have business implications. And so mm-hmm. that inhibits organizations from allowing access to that data.
Sure, of course.
So the way we've approached that is to, because we say, well, we need this heterogeneous set of data. We need data from the environment, physical data like weather.
Right.
We need biological information from the environment, such as pathogens in the water. We need non-human clinical data, companion animals, animals for food, wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
We want the middle of the Oriole, which is human clinical data. And then we want business organizational data, because your loyalty program at the supermarket records the pattern of your purchases, your over-the-counter purchases, and sometimes other things that aren't medications may be early signals of a health issue.
Sure.
And then, of course,
if suddenly there's a run on bathroom tissue or
exactly,
something.
Exactly, exactly. And and then for us, the most the highest, most abstract form of data is social media.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in a way, we've created this hierarchy from the physical world to the online world,
okay,
and saying there are about six levels here, and we need data from all of them.
Well, Dave, this is very exciting, and we are just about out of time, believe it or not. Very briefly, kind of summarize where NCB Prepared is headed.
Okay. We are moving to a production-ready system. We have a very robust system. But we recognize in order to address the data space that we want to, it has to be not just larger, but always available. These threats exist all the time, 24/7.
Of course.
And we need the ability to be able to ingest these varieties of data, generate information, and then make that available to relevant users in the public health community, the healthcare community, the business community.
Mm-hmm.
In food safety, we think that one of the challenges there is that foodborne outbreaks and their understanding, the understanding tends to lag far behind the event itself. And we want to bring it up at least even to the event so people can understand it as it unfolds rather than a week or a month or sometimes a year later.
Sure.
So by early part of next year, we will have this production capability in place. We have a dashboard. We've shown it to a lot of people. Unfortunately, it wouldn't work to show it on radio.
Indeed.
But it allows us to visualize information in something called a heat map.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that uses colors to be able to show where it's hot, where it's cold, where there is activity, where there isn't. We have maps that show specifically, this is a cluster of alerts in this area. You can zoom in to look at it a little more closely. You can zoom out to look at it more generally. Of course, we show trends in graphs. And sometimes people just want to look at the alert line listing. And so one of the things that we're trying to do, and this is what we'll start doing on a prototypical basis next year, is move beyond just working with the user communities to understand their needs and develop methods to present and support them, but that we want to create prototypical information products,
mm-hmm, okay,
depending upon what their concerns and needs are, that allow us to grow and spread the use of our approach so that this becomes useful across a whole array of user groups, from school nurses to people who are in food chain safety management and all the points in between. And the idea is bring this information, incredibly powerful information that was impossible before now because mm-hmm. we just didn't have the tools or capabilities, to the people who are on the front line in the locality so that they can take appropriate action and make the appropriate response and hopefully mitigate whatever that issue is.
Sure. Well, that's very, very exciting, and it sounds like you've made a great deal of progress over the last couple of years, and we will certainly be keeping an eye on NCB Prepared and see where you go in the next couple of years, and hopefully watch for this to roll out nationally as well. So,
Thanks
so much for your time and wisdom today on Radio in Vivo. It's a terrific organization, and I'm sure it's going to be paying some very significant dividends in the future.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio in Vivo. You can check out the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. Join us next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we do ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. We are actively seeking new partners to underwrite our shows, particularly right now. So we ask that you go to the website and find out more about our 50 by 100 campaign. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.